Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 8th, 2002, and this session is entitled Empowering Images, TV and Social Change, Session 4, The Bread of Life. It is presented by John DeGraff, and it is number DEJ2002-05. Let's listen in.
I think the way we grow food and feed people, both here in the United States and around the world, and of course, importantly, that we begin to somehow make a dent in world hunger, which the latest estimates are that there are still about 815 million people, or something like 1/6 of the population of the world, that are chronically hungry, chronically malnourished. The figures of the number of children, for instance, who die from hunger and hunger-related diseases in the world are staggering, still something around 14 million per year. The Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations has set a goal, and they set it 5 years ago, and then they just had another World Food Summit in Rome, which I attended 2 months ago, to try to cut the number of hungry people in half by the year 2015. And that would require that we actually reduce the number of hungry people by about 30 million a year in the world. But in fact, we're only reducing it by about 6 million per year. And virtually all of that reduction is taking place in China. In Africa, for example, the situation, food for people is actually continuing to get worse. The number of calories that people have to consume is lower. The combinations of wars, of political conflict, corruption, and population, and then issues affecting the land, deterioration of land quality, growing deserts, drought, all of these kinds of things has created tremendous pressure. And we have to figure out some ways to find answers to these. But what I'm going to show you is three separate stories about people who are trying in some way to deal with these issues relating to how we produce food for people around the world, and also how we produce food here at home. The first of them is a story that I did back in the mid-1980s, and it's a story about an individual who at that time had already been working some nearly 15 years on the issue of world hunger, trying actually in one small place to come up with some ways to grow food far more effectively, organically, in small spaces with land that wasn't at all good. And the interesting thing was that even in 1985, when I was working on it, this gentleman, John Jevons, his name is, based in Willits, California, was considered as something of a kook by the agricultural powers that be, the institutions at the University of California at Davis, for example, the big ag school in California. I think they looked at John as really being a little bit of a quack. And the fascinating thing is how much that has changed, and how that one individual, surrounded by some people who cared about his work and kind of came in and out and helped him with the work, has been able to accomplish a tremendous amount. I'm going to show you a little clip from the film about John Jevons' work, and then just tell you a tiny bit about what's happened in the 17 years since this was made.
John Jevons is a master gardener and a man with a mission. What we're going to be able to do is use our units of water, fertilizer, and soil 10 times more efficiently than is being done now. For 15 years, Jevons and several associates have been testing and perfecting what they call biointensive agriculture. Mm-hmm. It's an organic gardening technique capable of producing crop yields much higher than those of modern commercial farming. The Willits Garden Project, known as Common Ground, attracts visitors from all over the world. The center of the garden is a thickly planted 1,000-square-foot circle.
This is the area that we believe minimally you can grow one complete balanced vegetarian diet in, or on the average.
This circle covers only 1/40th of an acre. American commercial farming now requires 10 times that much land to grow a complete diet. Some third world countries need 30 times as much. And many of those countries are running out of arable land. John Jevons and his fellow gardeners enjoy homegrown meals half the world would envy. Jevons once worked for the U.S. Agency for International Development. He realized then that unless ways were found to grow more food on less land, millions of people faced a future of famine. The famines have come, sweeping across drought-stricken Africa, carried by television into American living rooms. In 1984, 45 million people died of hunger or hunger-related diseases. As many as 500 million more may die within a decade. Massive food shifts bring temporary reprieve for many on hunger's death row. But such generosity provides no long-term answer to famine.
For all intents and purposes, what most of us are really doing is just changing the location of the deck chairs on the Titanic. We're not doing something that is going to build a sophisticated low-technology safety net.
When the bags of imported grain are empty and gone, the roots of the food crisis will remain. On soil which once provided subsistence for millions, large landowners now often grow only cash crops for export. Commercial farming practices frequently damage the soil. As population grows, trees that once held moisture in the earth are stripped for firewood, and deserts expand. At best, by the year 2000, there will only be half as much cropland per person on Earth as there was in 1950. A quarter of the world's people are malnourished. How can they be fed?
For now getting close to 30 years, John Jevons has been working on these very productive and intensive organic agriculture methods. His aim has been to produce a complete diet for people in 1,000 square feet of land, and as yet that hasn't been realized. I think they're at a point where that's possible at about 2,500 square feet, or still about a fourth as much as even now done by commercial agriculture. But the interesting thing is the way in which many, many countries around the world have begun to adopt John's work. And a fellow who was basically considered just way out there 20 years ago. 2 years ago, I attended a conference at the University of California at Davis, where that school honored John Jevons for his work in really figuring out some things that could be effective in poor countries in feeding people. And there were representatives from countries all over the world there, where John's work is now being used in very poor communities to help people feed themselves. For example, in Mexico alone, some 7 million families now use this particular method that John Jevons developed through a program that the Mexican government started working by working with John some 15, actually right about at the time that this film was made. And in places where these kinds of things are being done, there are big projects in Kenya and Argentina and the Philippines and in Russia and many, many other countries. It's quite remarkable how much particularly people can do to supplement. And it's, I think, an alternative to just the spread of huge corporate agribusiness around the world. Any questions about this? Yeah?
I'm not clear on exactly what it is that he was doing. It looked like things were very closely bunched together.
Yeah.
And is the soil especially amended, or, you know, how is it possible to do that?
I'm sorry, I should have started with that. I don't know if any of you have seen the very popular book. It's called How to Grow More Vegetables Than You Ever Thought Possible on Less Land Than You Can Imagine. It's,
yeah,
it's sold millions of copies now,
yeah,
and it's been translated into some 30 languages. It's the book that John Jevons wrote about the method. And basically, these kinds of methods use very old techniques that with new scientific thinking about how to put certain crops together in companion planting and other things that help. But the heart of it is digging deep first and aerating the soil and allowing the roots to go down straight instead of spreading out, and allowing you to plant things much more closely together. This not only gets, you know, more plants in a space, but it also actually starves out or keeps out the weeds and the other kinds of things from getting into the land. And it needs all of these methods, and they're complicated. They need to be coupled with various kinds of biological controls on insects and things that we are learning. But there's an immense amount of knowledge. And what I showed this for is that it's just a very different way, a smaller and different way of looking at how we produce food and feed people. And it's just that also for me, having known John now for some 24 years and seen his work over that time, and now going to Willits and seeing just what an amazing place this is and what how things grow there, and the people who are coming by the hundreds every year from different countries to train and take these ideas back home. It's been just an amazing example, an inspiration to me, just of the power of one person with a vision and a dream, who really stayed where he was. I mean, John, for almost 20 years, John didn't travel. He just stayed in Willits. He worked on this whole thing in order to prove it could happen on bad land. And then not until then did he actually begin to take the invitations to go to other places in the world and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how do you spell that last name?
Jevons.
The book is really fairly common. I mean, I got it from the library and they had several copies. You know, my little county library. I mean, it's been out for a long time.
Oh yeah, he wrote the first edition about 20 years ago.
I was going to say, mm-hmm. Yeah, that was in the 70s.
Then it was Spanish was the first language that it was translated into, probably about 1983 or 84, when the beginnings of the program in Mexico started. And there's been a lot of studies in the communities, in some small communities in northern Mexico that have used this, about the actual decline in malnutrition and everything. It's been quite significant. Doctors have said, geez, you know, the families that do this and the communities that do this really makes a difference for the kids. These aren't people who are starving to death. It's not like that. But still, it's made a huge difference.
What was planted in their plot that was a complete meal, that was the protein?
For protein?
Mm-hmm.
Well, a number of things. I mean, wheat, for example. But they, I don't think they plant soy there, but mm-hmm. certainly lots of bean types, okay. various types of beans. I don't think he grows soy, mm-hmm. but I'm not sure about that. But many kinds of beans and wheat and I would have to look at the way the book lays that out.
Mm-hmm. I've been hesitating to ask this question since the very first time you started because I may get laughed out of here. But for me, in my life, I have a favorite movie that to me is a metaphor, even though it isn't really on this topic, it's a metaphor for this whole thing, and that's the Milagro Beanfield War.
It's one of my absolute favorite movies. If anybody hasn't seen that movie, it's just one of my favorites.
And in case it isn't evident to everybody what that is about, it really was about how the greed of people to take land out of agricultural production, to use it as for people who already are very rich, to in a sense, steal it from the poorer people who need it for subsistence to live on. Yeah, it's
turn it into a big, golf course developments and all of the kind of
big resort.
That was a film that came out in the late 80s, directed by Robert Redford and based on a novel written by John Nichols, a New Mexican author. And I just think it's a wonderful story. It's one of the few films I've ever seen that doesn't just have this sort of single hero, but in fact it's a whole community that everybody's kind of made to act better by the fact that that they care about the other people in the community and what the other people in the community think about them. It's sort of the opposite of some of the things where we, what people think of us makes us do the wrong things, but this is where people reluctantly do the right things the term comes about because this poor farmer's, Hispanic farmer's Beanfield is, he diverts water from this huge development project into his little bean field to grow his beans because the water has been stolen for this huge development. And it creates this battle between these small farmers in this little northern New Mexico town and the big developers who have everybody behind them, including the governor and the FBI. And it's a very, very funny movie, too. But I love that film. The next little clip I want to show you is a story that can be duplicated, I think, in many, many communities. And this is also a story, again, of a person who we just had a wonderful conversation in Marcia Bungie's session about the whole idea of vocation or calling, the work that an individual is called to do to serve the larger community in the world. And I think Michael Abelman, who's a remarkable gardener, writer, and photographer, found a calling. And one of the ways he found a calling was in using his photography to help teach people about a different way to do agriculture, to grow food and distribute it fairly. And he, for 20 years, ran a community garden in Santa Barbara, California, called Fairview Gardens, and they had to fight people who wanted that land for development. I mean, this was a 20-year struggle against developers who were trying all kinds of things to push out this community farm, because if you've been to Santa Barbara, you know this is a very expensive community where land, if you could turn this farmland into condominiums, it's going to be worth a lot of money. But Michael had the great skill of bringing together the whole community, of turning the garden into a place where, the farm into a place where children from the schools could learn about food and agriculture, of getting everybody involved and seeing why this was a little miracle of land within this community, and eventually they saved the land. And it's quite a remarkable story. He's written two wonderful books, one called From the Good Earth, about traditional farming around the world, and the second one called On Good Land, about the farm in Santa Barbara and the struggle to save it from development. Meryl Streep narrated this film for me, which was really a nice thing. She's a big supporter of community-supported and organic agriculture. So I'm just going to show you where we start here. I've already introduced Michael Abelman as having come to this farm in 1980 to work on this and manage this little organic farm that this elderly couple owned in Santa Barbara. And Michael's been working on the farm for a year or two, and it's suddenly in the early 80s, there's an enormous boom of houses being built everywhere and everything. He has to figure out how to deal with it.
In the early 1980s, Irvin Sproul discovered the Goleta Valley. Hundreds of acres of farmland were rezoned for residential development.
I began to see that the neighborhood was changing, that the Goleta Valley was no longer an agricultural region. I knew that if this place was going to survive economically, that we had to change our direction and our focus to appeal to the thousands of people that were moving in around us.
It was time to diversify. Michael and his crew began planting other crops.
Lettuce and broccoli and carrots and cabbage and potatoes and on until before I knew it, this place had been colored in with 100 different fruits and vegetables, incredibly diverse.
Came to buy the tasty organic produce being grown at Fairview Gardens and sold at several local markets. The farm began to prosper.
In the early days, we never talked about organic. We never used that word. We gave people a tree-ripe peach to taste. When we first started selling corn at the produce stand, some people would almost faint when they'd encounter an earworm. And it took us a long time to educate people to the fact that the sign of an earworm is a sign that no poisons have been used.
Blessed with skilled co-workers who could help to run the farm, Michael was occasionally able to take time off and travel, especially during winter. One of his first trips took him to mainland China.
What I saw completely blew my mind, really. There was this expanse, for as far as I could see, this amazing network of fields of vegetables surrounded by waterways and pathways, all being worked by families working together in these fields. And this land was land that not only had been worked by these people's parents and grandparents, but by their great-grandparents and their great-great-grandparents, and in some cases all the way back for some 4,000 years, the same land. And I thought to myself, well, wait a minute, you know, how could these people maintain the same land for 4,000 years when we can deplete ours in this part of the world, in some cases, in a decade, in 10 years?
What began with a trip to China became, in succeeding years, a journey through five continents, camera in hand.
I had studied photography, but my photography was art for art's sake without any particular borders. I didn't have a story to tell. Suddenly, the photographer who had been dormant for so long and the farmer found a common voice. And I began photographing like crazy.
His slides would become a book called From the Good Earth, filled with powerful images of land and people.
I was fascinated by what I had heard about what was going on in the Andes, in the mountains of Peru, where people were farming land that was so steep that farmers had been known to fall out of their fields. I witnessed fields of potatoes the size of most people's front lawn, with some 30, 40 varieties in a single field.
Such diversity, the farmers explained, helped keep pests in check.
I spent another winter in Africa, which was fascinating as well. I traveled to visit the Hopi in Arizona to see how a people could survive in really one of the harshest climates, often without irrigation water. Then I began to develop this sense that there were some things that we could learn from these traditional cultures.
He brought along photographs of Fairview Gardens to show farmers in other countries what he and his colleagues were doing at home. On one excursion, he traveled with a companion through the wheat fields of Sicily. They were welcomed everywhere as honored guests.
It got to the point, quite literally, where everywhere we left with arms full of homemade pasta sauce in bottles, or olive oil, or wine, or bread, or cheese. And the car smelled like a traveling delicatessen. The poorer the people were, the more they offered you.
His hosts had few material goods, but they were rich in other ways. In their connections to the land, in their relationships to each other, in culture, tradition, and community. But back in the United States, Michael saw things less endearing. Vast acreage planted to a single crop, immensely susceptible to pests and disease, and protected only by floods of chemicals. Small farmers forced out of business, selling their lands to giant conglomerates. Tasteless, uniform produce, packaged in plastic and transported across continents. In the Central Valley of California, where 40% of America's vegetables are grown, he found a stark and silent landscape.
The first thing that I noticed was it was absolutely desolate. Where were the people? There were no families working the fields. I didn't see any birds. There were no insects buzzing. All that I could see were these flat fields, often with a single tractor, you know, maybe moving its way along.
Where, too, was the welcome he'd found all over the world?
They didn't want me there. I had to lie. I had to tell them that I was photographing for a school project in order to do what I was doing. The only people who entered those fields were people who had paid $1,000 to be led across the border and shipped like baggage to harvest and to hoe, period. Everything else was done by machines. I really responded in a very kind of, really a very emotional way to what I was experiencing. After I saw what was going on visually, I felt driven to learn a little bit more about why it was happening and what exactly was happening.
The facts, gleaned from books and scientific reports, were no less alarming than what he'd seen. He learned that 46 acres of prime American farmland is converted to non-agricultural uses every hour. That California is losing topsoil at a rate 80 times faster than nature can rebuild it. That the average bite of food eaten in America travels more than 1,000 miles from field to plate, requiring an immense expenditure of energy. That pesticides poison 70,000 Americans and 1 million people worldwide every year, sometimes fatally. And that chemical agriculture is the largest source of groundwater pollution in the United States.
We pay less for food than any country in the world, but we're paying for it in our health, we're paying for it in the loss of topsoil, in the pollution of groundwater, and the people who are doing the work are paying for it.
Troubled, Michael Abelman looked elsewhere in the United States for signs of hope. And he found them in farmers markets, urban gardens, and other organic farms. There was a movement afoot all around the country, seeking a new relationship with the land and with food, and he was glad to be part. The farm grew increasingly productive and successful, finding new markets for its produce. But it was the calm before the storm. Farming is always a risky proposition. Too little rain or too much, an entire planting can be lost to a single cloudburst. But by the late 1980s, weather was the least of Michael Abelman's worries. Fairview Gardens was endangered. Almost overnight, the entire area adjoining the farm began filling up with houses.
It was really an assault. The construction would start at 7 o'clock every morning and would go straight through the day all the way to evening. There was dust everywhere. That land next door was riparian habitat. There was tons of life. There was deer and possum and raccoons and coyote and hundreds of different types of birds.
In a matter of months, it was all gone. Fairview Gardens was completely encircled by houses and strip malls.
Then the moving van started lining up. The kids that moved in gravitated here. They started playing on our compost piles and building forts in the orchards.
But their parents began to complain.
They weren't used to living next to a farm. So they weren't used to hearing roosters crow early in the morning.
At first, they were mad at Sabat's compost.
I see the borders of the farm as extending beyond the edges of the fields. We provide the nourishment for the local community, and in turn, we should be receiving waste and material being generated by the community. We should use that, recycle it.
His neighbors disagreed. They demanded that the piles be removed and got a letter from the health department ordering Fairview to stop composting.
I was threatened with jail time over that compost. What we did, though, is we invited all the neighbors over for a dinner to talk about the new relationship. And we served them a homegrown meal. And we talked about what their needs were, what we were trying to do here.
The neighbors agreed to let the compost compost. But a year later, the complaints resumed. Seems that some of the newcomers were getting less sleep than they'd been used to. They blamed the roosters, demanding their removal from the farm.
This proved to be a much more drawn-out, extensive battle. Eventually, there was a big hearing at the county, where the county officials suggested in all earnestness that we cut the vocal cords of the offending bees.
Oh.
But for every neighbor who complained, another came forward to defend the farm.
That was really a neat place to go and visit when I first started going over there, because you can just walk around the farm and, you know, look at all the activities that are happening. And it kind of just draws you in immediately.
They got a lot of people out to the farm, and I think that's what started getting it in everybody's mind, that this was really a treasure that they have in the community that really deserved to be protected and taken care of.
The rooster riot, as the incident came to a call, brought a flood of supporters to a public hearing, and in the end, the county backed down.
Notorious rooster. Michael speaks in all parts of the country now. He's been very active in the urban agriculture movement, and also in the reason this program that this is taken from is called Beyond Organic is that Michael points out wherever he speaks that when we talk about agriculture and food, It's not enough just to say, well, we want organic food, but that we also have to really consider how far food travels, what kind of energy is used, and how fair the treatment is to the people who are growing the food or the farm workers who are working on the land and the farm. And I think the situation there, Michael's farm is really a community. There are about 30 people who work on the farm, and many of them are, probably half of them are farm workers who originally came up from Mexico but have now stayed and are part of the farm community and are part of the decision making. And I think Michael thinks that's also just an essential thing, that some fairness be brought into the agricultural system for farmers and for farm workers, that's something to consider, as well as the fact that food is organic. Any questions about this particular? They went through many battles, but they finally won, and that the farm was saved when the community of Santa Barbara gathered around and actually bought the land itself and turned it into a land trust, which Susan Ballinger talked about earlier today. They did that, and so now the farm is protected as a land trust and as an educational institution. It's called the Center for Urban Horticulture. And they bring in thousands of school kids each year who see the process and learn about food. They're working with schools around the state of California, because California is trying to develop a program which will eventually have a garden in every elementary school. Kids can learn from stuff. So Michael's work is pretty inspiring. He's actually left that farm and is now building a new farm up on Salt Spring Island in British Columbia. So, but I recommend for anybody interested in it to particularly read his first book, From the Good Earth, his look around the world at farming and the contrast between what he saw in these countries and then when he came back and looked at large-scale commercial farming in California. Any questions about this one? The last thing I'm going to show is a rather different story. One of the problems that I became aware of in the early 90s with an interest in food was the fact that we're really very rapidly losing biodiversity around the world in seeds. Through the spread of these monocultures and the single very high yielding varieties that commercial varieties, we've lost a lot of the older varieties, which didn't produce as well but may have other qualities like disease resistance and drought resistance and things that our higher yielding varieties don't have. And some of these have been saved. Many of them have been saved in seed banks and are continuing to be saved. And others now are, there's a wonderful organization in Decorah, Iowa called the Seed Savers Exchange that helps people save these heirloom varieties of seeds and exchange them with each other all around the country. But the whole original idea of seed saving and of the importance of this genetic variety around the world really first came, was really, I think, first explored in depth by a famous Russian scientist. And how many people saw hot potatoes? Okay, a few of you were here. Hot potatoes. Hot potatoes tells the story of John Niederhauser, the young American scientist who went to Russia in 1935 and had the chance encounter of meeting Nikolai Vavilov, the great Russian scientist. So some of the story I'm going to show you now is repeated in Hot Potatoes, because it was this film, Genetic Time Bomb, and this story about the Russian scientists and their seeds that ended up, when it was on PBS, in my getting a call from John Niederhauser's daughter, who saw it and said, you know, you should really meet my father. He was part of this. He met this Russian scientist years ago, and he's now trying to fight the potato blight that's all over around the world. And it was one of these kind of things. I'll try to make this really short, but these sort of experiences that happen that you sort of know that you have to do something. You're kind of, it comes and grabs you and calls you to do it. And that film was one of them, because I happened to be in San Francisco and I was about to go to the airport to fly back to Seattle, and I checked my voicemail messages, and there was the message from this woman saying, oh, I just saw your film last night. I didn't even know it was on San Francisco that night. I'd been there, but it was on KQED, the San Francisco PBS station, that night, and I wasn't even aware of that, but she had seen it, and she said, she didn't say actually San Francisco, she said, I saw your film on PBS last night, and told me, mentioned her father, and said, I really wish you would call me so I could tell you about my dad and what he's doing. And the number that she left was 415, and that's the San Francisco area code. So I thought, geez, you know, maybe I'll call her now, you know, before I go to the airport, because it's a local call. Maybe, and I had a, you know, short time. And so I called up, and she answered the phone, and she said, where are you? And I said, well, I was at a little hotel, a motel in the marina. And I told her, and she said, well, I'm 6 blocks away. She said, let me come over and meet you and bring to you some stuff about my father. And I said, well, I have to go to, I'm heading out to the airport really soon. And she says, oh, I'll take you, don't worry about it. I'll come and bring you the stuff. And so she did, it was fascinating. And I said, so where does your father live? Because the whole story fascinated me. And she said, well, he lives in Tucson, Arizona. And being, it just turned out, I'd never been to Tucson, Arizona before, but I was going there 2 days later on another project. So 2 days after the woman left the message for me on my voicemail, I was meeting her father in Tucson, Arizona, and hearing his story, and that led to the making of the other film, Hot Potatoes, and his story, of course, he's been a great inspiration to me as well. But I want to show you this clip, a little story about Nikolai Vavilov and the Russian scientists who we owe a great deal of debt to, that most Americans have never heard of, but who really saved a tremendous amount of seeds from around the world, some of which have helped solve and deal with very key plant diseases, particularly in wheat here in the United States, and may be responsible for the daily bread we all have.
I always forget to eject more trees.
St. Isaac Square, St. Petersburg, Russia. In this building, the science of crop genetic diversity was born. This is the office where Nikolai Vavilov worked for more than 2 decades. As director of the prestigious Soviet Institute of Plant Industry, Vavilov believed that diverse collections of seeds were needed to improve crop breeding programs. Beginning in 1916, he gathered seeds and tubers the world over in wild places where few Westerners had ever been before. Harsh deserts, mountains, thick jungles. And his assistants collected nearly 200,000 varieties of crops. At St. Petersburg, then called Leningrad, Vavilov established the world's first seed bank to store and grow out his collections. In 1926, he published his groundbreaking work, Studies on the Origin of Cultivated Plants. Vavilov argued that each of the world's crops, no matter how widely they are now grown, were originally domesticated in 8 separate centers of origin. For example, the center of origin for corn was Central America. For wheat, the Middle East. For potatoes, the Andes. And for rice, Southeast Asia. Perhaps more importantly, Vavilov discovered that one was likely to find the most diversity for a crop in its center of origin, since it was there that the crop had evolved longest with climate changes, pests, and disease.
His ideas of centers of diversity and origin pointed the way to future geneticists and plant breeders as to the areas where they should concentrate their efforts in looking for new characters which they didn't have already.
By the mid-30s, Vavilov was widely recognized as the world's greatest geneticist. A steady stream of foreign visitors came to see him at Leningrad.
Oh, he was a larger-than-life character. Extremely charming and friendly. Treated me, a young graduate student, as I were an honored colleague of many years standing, of course impressed me extremely.
In the eyes of the scientific world, Vavilov stood on a pedestal. But at home, he was in trouble.
He was not against the system, but the system was against him.
In the USSR, the science of genetics was under attack. Trofim Lysenko, a biologist, convinced Stalin that Vavilov's activities were wasted effort, that there were quicker ways to improve Soviet agriculture. Lysenko claimed, for example, that if seeds were soaked in cold water before planting, their offspring could acquire the ability to survive in colder climates.
Lysenko was a charlatan. He stood for fictions. Fictions that was beloved by Stalin and his entourage. Because he promised miracles in agriculture.
Vavilov and his assistants defended genetics against Lysenko's bizarre theories, receiving Stalin's wrath in return.
Every day we were coming to work and we just knew that somebody is arrested. Today this professor, next day another one.
In 1940, Vavilov himself was arrested by the secret police and charged with being an enemy of the state. In prison, he was interrogated and tortured.
Night after night after night after night, 1,700 hours. And then he was sentenced to death.
In August of 1941, only a year after Vavilov's arrest, the German army attacked Leningrad and blockaded the city. By fall, supplies started running out. By winter, the ration of bread had been cut to 4 ounces a day.
German pilots swooped down and bombed us. There were stashes of sugar, and when they were bombing, everything burned out. The sugar melted into the dirt, and so we ate the dirt.
It was one of the most bitter winters in the city's history, with the temperature falling to 40 degrees below zero. 600,000 citizens of Leningrad died of starvation. At Vavilov's Institute, the scientists worked desperately to protect their seeds.
Many people knew of the Institute and that there was a lot of seed and grain here. The scientists were terribly afraid that starving people might try to break into the building.
Then, as conditions grew steadily worse, Vavilov's colleagues faced the devil's choice: boil and eat the seeds, or starve to death.
You have to imagine the situation. War, Germans, these hungry people, hundreds of thousands, dying in streets, laying there. They themselves, their families, have no food. But they use these seeds. They are priceless.
First, Dr. Dmitry Ivanov, director of the rice collection, died at his desk.
What the class even know? When he died and the people opened his room, they found Dr. Ivanov dead from hunger, with all his collection of rice around him in the same room, and even on his table.
One by one, 9 scientists, surrounded by tons of edible seeds, perished from hunger, thus saving the seeds that would have saved them. The defense of Leningrad lasted for 900 days, leaving a million dead and the city in ruins. The area around the seed bank, though, was spared from the bombing because Hitler had planned a victory celebration at the adjacent Astoria Hotel. And what finally of Nikolai Vavilov? Though his death sentence was commuted, the man whose discoveries had helped feed millions of people starved to death in prison on January 26,
1943. So it was, I had the chance to go there in 1993 and talk to, you know, some of the still living scientists and who had been part of all this and hear the stories. And of course, people there really understand what happened. And I'm hoping to go back actually to St. Petersburg next month. Kind of have to talk my family into it. I'm always talking about having time in here. But the Hot Potatoes has been selected for a major international environmental film festival that's held each year in St. Petersburg. And so they want me to come, and I would like to come very much. But we'll see if that'll happen. But one of these days, I would also like to really do a documentary about the life of Nikolai Vavilov, because I think his story is so fascinating. What happened to him? What
became of Lysenko?
Lysenko was still actually had a lot of real power and influence for about 25 years after the death of Vavilov. Sakharov, the great Russian physicist, was one of the first to really expose Lysenko as a fake and to challenge him in the Soviet Academy of Sciences in 1968, that late. Lysenko, there's a great book called The Lysenko Affair. There's other books, Vavilov and Lysenko, a lot of stories about, and books written about all of this. And the Russians, in fact, made a 13-part television series called Vavilov and Lysenko. And the guy who played Lysenko apparently won the Soviet Academy Award for acting. And people said, this slimy guy, this actor was. But Lysenko died in 1976. Still holding, he worked until he was, I think he was about 79 years old when he died. He was still working at the university. He'd been kind of, discredited, but he never lost his job or anything. He lost his great power. The interesting thing about Lysenko, he's a sort of a fascinating, almost tragic character himself, because by all accounts, Lysenko wanted nothing in a material sense personally for himself. He was an absolute ascetic. Most people around him considered him the most generous man they've ever met. He just gave away everything. He was totally obsessed with personal power. That was his gold, if you will. He always lived in a very. He was the son of a peasant and made a great deal of the fact that he was a proletarian, that he was a poor man, and that Vavilov, his opponent, was the son of a former businessman from Moscow.
James Burke and some other, I guess you could call them historians, regarded this thing with Lysenko and the Russian agricultural programs as a part of the weakening of the Soviet system that eventually led to its downfall.
I don't think there's any question that that's true. It really set back Russian agriculture immensely, all these programs that Vavilov had established, which were then taken up in other countries. The system of seed banks, we now have in Fort Collins, Colorado, we have a great national seed storage system that has seeds from all, something like 225,000 species of seeds from around the world. But we've had a number of occasions where scientists searching through the seed collections in the United States in order to find seeds that had resistance to a particular wheat blight or some other disease have ended up using the seeds for breeding to solve those, have ended up using seeds that Nikolai Vavilov collected in places like Iran and other parts of the Middle East way back in 1916, 1918.
And they'll still germinate 90 years later?
They're kept, actually wheat will germinate for a long time, but they're kept under very, perfect conditions. And in Vavilov's case, all those things were grown out over and over again because they didn't have that kind of cool, now you have these tanks. If you go to the seed storage laboratory in Fort Collins, you see these tanks of basically incredibly cold stuff that seeds are put down in that'll keep them essentially virtually forever. But they didn't have that. They were growing things out. And then some of their seed, most of their wheat seeds and things, they didn't have to grow them out every year by any means. They might last 10, 15 years under those conditions. But potatoes, they had to grow out every year. So they were, I went to the place where the scientists were. They would have to go out under the Nazi bombing and keep trying to go grow these potatoes, at night and other kinds of times. Horrible stories that you hear. But these scientists so believed that these seed collections, and they knew then that the seeds were starting and these varieties were starting to disappear. They also knew how valuable they would be for the future of crop breeding. They were willing to sacrifice themselves because they thought the seeds were priceless, that they couldn't be replaced, and if they ate them, there would be no answer.
Do you know of anybody that has written along the line that somehow this terrible experience of Soviet agriculture as a kind of a warning, a prophetic warning for the American agricultural establishment of what could happen if they get into deep monoculture and ignore all these other?
Oh, I think most American scientists are now very aware of that danger, which doesn't mean that we're not still planting a lot of monocultures. I think what they now say is that, we do have these huge seed collections that are protected, that we've analyzed, that we know what the traits are.
They have fallback, you're saying?
Yeah, they say now that there's a fallback, we do have this kind of thing. But that doesn't mean that we couldn't have some serious short-run problems as disease. We had a corn blight in 1980 that hit the American corn industry and was tremendously devastating. Wiped out about 20% of the corn crop. And again, much of this corn had been grown in monoculture types, and they actually had to eliminate a whole type of corn use. Mm-hmm.
This is on a little different topic, and I apologize if you've already answered this, but I was just wondering if you could talk for a second about how you approach one of your films. Do you write the script and do everything, or what's going on there? Or is it different with each film?
Well, I mean, very rarely is the film my idea. Usually, the last idea I had was running out of time, and that's 10 years ago, basically. That idea germinated in my mind. So almost all of these things, like the genetic time bomb, people came to me with that idea. Hot Potatoes, the daughter of John Niederhauser, came to me after seeing genetic time bomb. What I then do is I kind of have to evaluate, do I think, number one, do I believe in this topic? Do I think it's important, and do I want to tell this story? And then number two, is there any possibility of getting any money from anybody to make this happen? Because these things are expensive. So I have to go out and look for the money, write proposals and that. Sometimes the TV station helps a little bit with that. And then I'm responsible for basically selecting the camera crew. I don't do camera myself. I sometimes do sound when we have a really low budget. I don't like to do it because I'm no good at it, but I can do it if I have to do it. Then I will do, either I or not, often work with a co-producer, so one of us will be interviewing, doing pre-interviews with subjects and then interviewing them with a camera, and directing the camera people for all the other material. We usually have archival researchers in Washington, D.C. and New York who actually find footage for us because they know where all that stuff is. We pay for that to be done. I used to do it myself. It's not cost effective. And then I write a script after we get all the material, and I do the editing. Yeah.
Have you come across or have you heard of any of the books by Margaret Visser, the Canadian, about the extent to which corn runs the economy in the U.S.?
I have.
What is the title of that?
Something about dinner.
Yeah, it's marvelous. It analyzes the way a typical American meal is prepared and all the ramifications of how all of these things relate to the rest of our life and the extent to which corn, I mean seriously corn, is the central feature of life.
Like for example, those plastic bags that you get at a supermarket, those are made of cornstarch. And they biodegrade.
She goes into literally thousands of things that are related to that.
Oh, that's delightful. That's great. Well, bringing up the subject of dinner, I think you're all ready, having seen food here and having had a light lunch for an hungry day. You're probably all anxious to go get something to eat. Thank you.
Thank you.